This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's a cold night in Boston and people are going out. The Depression and Prohibition are in the rearview mirror. There's a world war happening, but on foreign soil. The Holy Cross football team has done the unthinkable. They beat the undefeated Boston College at Fenway Park. And at the Coconut Grove Lounge on Piedmont Street, people of all ages, whole families, couples, friends, are packing the joint. Waiters squeeze tables together to fit everyone in, and hours pass without incident. Until a little before 10:30 p.m., that's when patrons see a small fire aflame in the basement of the lounge under a decorative palm tree. And in less than 10 minutes, that one flame consumes the club. And by the end of the night, hundreds are dead, and a city is changed forever. November 28th, 1942. It's 80 years since the infamous Coconut Grove fire, and its legacy continues in ways I didn't even imagine. Stephanie Shoro has updated her book, The Coconut Grove Nightclub Fire, A Boston Tragedy, in honor of the 80th, and joins us now here in Studio 2. Stephanie, welcome.
Great. Thank you for having me.
It's haunting.
It is. It's something that has haunted Boston and generations of Bostonians for 80 years. In my talking about it, I have talked to obviously victims, survivors of the fire, but their children and their children's children continue to be affected by this fire. And plus, as you noted, it has changed safety rules, saved other aspects of how we protect people in Boston. It also changed medical history, burn treatment, lung treatment, and psychological treatment. So it has had an amazing effect, not only on Boston, but on the entire country.
So we're going to spend some time with you now diving into this. And this is some tough stuff, so I just want listeners to know to listen with care. Before we go through what happened that night, though, the Coconut Grove, one of the things that was capturing about your book was you putting us in the space, right? The feel of this 1942 nightclub. So take us into the Coconut Grove space. Describe the decorations, how it's laid out. Get us in there.
Well, the Coconut Grove was considered the most glamorous spot in Boston. The thing about it, and it's kind of hard to tell from pictures, it was at a series of rooms. There was a top dining room with a big bar right off of it called the Caricature Lounge. Then there was a downstairs bar called the Melody Lounge, which is kind of a speakeasy kind of atmosphere. And then on the other side of the building, there was something called the new Cocktail Lounge. People call it the Broadway Lounge, but it was just a new lounge that was built on the Broadway side of the building, and that had just opened 10 days before the fire. Now, the thing about this club, it had entertainment at all these different levels. There was a singer downstairs, there was performers in the main dining room, and there were performers in the new lounge. So, as you said, it was packed.
Tap and jazz and vocal on a piano, kind of all that zeitgeist of 42 when it comes to entertainment.
Dancers, male and female dancers, singers, kind of an impresario who kind of led the entertainment that evening. That was Mickey Alpert. It was also a dining club, so people were eating and eating very sumptuous meals as well, and drinking, lots of drinking.
And we've got these palm trees decorated on the sides. We've got fabric on the walls and ceiling. We've got leatherette, I'm assuming.
Leatherette on the thing. Yeah, it was decorated to look like a sort of a South Sea paradise. It was based on the Coconut Grove nightclub in Los Angeles. So they kind of imported that concept to Boston. And so it was a lot of fake palm trees, a lot of zebra skin, special zebra kind of patterns on some of the furniture. And the roof, although this was not the case in the wintertime, but the roof could be rolled back so that people could dance under the stars.
All right, so now take us to that night, all right? So we're in this hot spot. It is packed. This Holy Cross Boston College thing has people going out like crazy, lots of people converging. It's a graded or credited, whatever the word is, for 500 people. How many people are in the nightclub?
At least 1,000 people. At least 1,000 people. And the thing about nightclubs in those days, that everybody went there. It was young people, like people on dates. There were service people there. There were whole families there. There were people celebrating their anniversaries. There was a couple had just gotten married, and they're celebrating their first night of marriage. So when you look at the face of the people, you see all ages. And you see people as young as 15 or 16 years old who are brought in by their parents. There were also 15, 16-year-old people who were working there. There were There were waiters. There were entertainers. It was absolutely packed. People talked about just how crowded it was. And that was one of the problems, because it was licensed to have 500 people. And we don't know how many people were there, but we estimate more than 1,000 people were packed in all levels of the club, from the new lounge down to the Melody Lounge.
So now take us to pages 54 and 55 of your book, which is, again, the Coconut Grove nightclub fire. This is from chapter 4, Into the Inferno, and we've picked a passage for you to read.
Yes, I'm going to read that, but let me just state one thing, because the fire started downstairs in the Melody Lounge and then swept up into the rest of the club, which is the thing that's the most mysterious about it.
Because how did it go from low to high?
Exactly.
Got it.
So let me read this passage. Most of the crowd did what people tend to do in a fire. They retreated to the entrance from which they entered. That meant those in the Melody Lounge ran up the stairs, although some of the staff tried to direct them through the door to the kitchen. They pressed against the exit door that led to the Piedmont Street, the door with a panic bar. It did not open. Dozens piled against it, beating on it with all their strength. It refused to budge. It was later found to be locked shut. Others made it to the top of the stairs and ran through the foyer toward the main exit, the revolving doors. Some foolishly stopped to try to retrieve their coats. By now, people in the dining room were aware something was happening, and many began to head for the revolving door to leave. A waiter tried to stop them, saying, "Nobody leaves until they pay their bill."
So that captures so much of what went down that night. So mm-hmm. there's an HBO documentary called Six Locked Doors, because there should have been six other places for people to get out, but they locked them. And it was largely because they didn't want anybody to sneak out without paying.
Part of the they didn't want to sneak out without getting paid. There was some discrepancy why they were locked, but the idea was to keep everybody in the club, make sure that they paid what was owed to the club managers. And the difficulty in getting out was, first of all, people go out the way they came in.
And they came in through the revolving door.
They came in through the revolving door, so that's where they went out. You see this all the time, like at the Station nightclub fire. Same thing happens in a lot of fires.
And that was Rhode Island in the early 2000s.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you for putting that out. But I think that was the situation there. And what happened is there were so many people trying to get out the revolving door that it jammed. It jammed shut. So no one could get in or out.
Because it was basically jammed with bodies.
It was jammed with people,
and
yes.
And after the fact, one of the things that was striking was people got out through a couple of windows. They got out through the roof and jumped down. But anywhere there was a door that should have been open or unlocked or any kind of possible egress, eventually you just had bodies piling up.
Right. There was a problem. There was something functionally wrong with almost every exit in that facility.
So let's stay with that piece for a minute, because part of this 80th anniversary is all the different ways that this Coconut Grove nightclub fire affects the way we live today. You know, it was really striking. I particularly dislike revolving doors. I don't know why.
I just don't
like them.
I don't like them anymore after doing this. I always check to see, because the law says that there should be two doors on either side, sort of regular doors.
And that's because of the Coconut Grove nightclub fire.
Right. Here's what's interesting about that is that they knew before then, the various fire agencies knew before them that revolving doors could do this and it was dangerous. But it wasn't until after the Coconut Grove that the city developed the political will to enforce these rules. We knew ahead of time you can't overcrowd. You should have lights showing exit space, where to go out. But before the Coconut Grove, there wasn't that political pressure and the ability to stand up to contractors and club owners to enforce these rules.
And that's another key piece of this story. So there are these two other things, Stephanie, one that you hit very hard, and then one that I was surprised you didn't hit harder, right? The one mm-hmm. that you hit very hard was all the lack of enforcement and the close relationship between the owners of the club and, let's say, Boston government, right?
Yes.
So they got away with unlicensed electric, and there was a lot of conversation about the mayor and I were tight, we fit.
We fit.
This
mayor
is going to be
fine.
Mayor
Tobin and I fit. Yeah.
Right. And there was a lot about that lack of enforcement and the buying off of politics and, you know, that kind of thing. The other thing was that there was a history of mob investment in this nightclub. And there were a lot of things that happened that you talk about in your book, a safe broken into and things stolen afterward, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. Disappearance of an envelope full of checks that looked like they might have been payoff checks to city exactly. officials. But you didn't hit the mob stuff hard, and I was surprised by that.
Well, that's because I need people to tell me their stories. Part of that is that there were at least three credible threats made against people after the fire, telling them don't investigate that. That has the markings of a kind of a mob investment. But they have taken their secrets to the grave. I keep hoping that someone will come forward and say what was in the safe that was discovered after the fire, they found that out. But the thing about the mob, let me put that in context. This was owned previously by a guy named King Solomon, or Charles King Solomon, who was a Jewish, you can't say mafia, but a Jewish mob boss who took over the place from the original owners. And then when he was shot dead at another club, it was taken over by his lawyer, who was also Jewish. And in fact, there was some fears that there would be a wave of anti-Semitism after the fire, which did not materialize.
Which is interesting given where we are today.
And when you say mob, I think that there was more of a connection between what we would now call the underworld and the overworld. Barney Wolanski.
Nightclub owner.
The lawyer, very high, had a brother named James, who was definitely a gangster. There's no question. He was very. And I know that's odd to think of in Boston, one brother's on one side of the law and another brother's on the other side of the law.
Have you met Bulger?
Exactly. So that's what I'm talking about, that there was more connection than we like to think between the underworld and regular people of society.
So there was so much iconic here. We're speaking with Stephanie Shoro. She's a historian and author of The Coconut Grove Nightclub Fire, a Boston Tragedy. It's the 80th anniversary this year. An anniversary. It's the 80th year since the fire.
Exactly.
Almost 500 people died, and it continues to be a painful piece of Boston history. One of the other things that really struck me, so we know there's now enforcement, how you decorate in a nightclub, fire codes, that kind of thing, taken much more seriously after this. The other thing that was really striking to me is this was a moment where there were two other innovations beginning in healthcare. One was penicillin, which was reserved for the military at that point. And the other was a polar opposite philosophy on how you deal with burns, mm-hmm. which is to protect rather than abrade, right? Pull
exactly.
off.
Exactly.
And this night and the overwhelm of the hospitals in the days after solidified these two major medical advances.
Exactly. I mean, the use of penicillin was the first time it was used for the Coconut Grove victims on a civilian population. Now, it was not given the way we now give it, so it was applied to the skin. So it's a little unclear exactly how much effect it had. However, it opened the door to the antibiotic era. The other—
I mean, we just have to stop for a second.
Yeah.
The antibiotic era is like, that's like opened the door to the printing press. Like, that's a really big deal.
No, it's a huge thing. And I think what the Coconut Grove did was make it this strange substance was now, this is a miracle drug. It was now viewed that way as opposed to with fear and trepidation, which can also happen among the American population. And the other aspect was this new, more intensive system levels approach to treating burns, which was pioneered at Mass General Hospital a little bit and also at Boston City Hospital. But that really changed the way that burns were treated. It also changed psychology. Some of our initial studies on what we now call post-traumatic shock were done on Coconut Grove survivors.
On survivors and on the healthcare professionals who had to care for them. At one point, one of the hospitals in Boston saw 100 patients come in like half an hour.
Exactly.
Right? With extreme burns. Many died over the next day or two. So a lot of understanding about post-traumatic stress from that time,
too. And also the use of nurses. I mean, one thing I do in my book is I try to elevate the position of nurses who did a lot of the bedside care, the kind of high touch treatment for a lot of these patients, which tends it doesn't get as much attention as I think it should, because they were very much involved in making sure those survivors, those people who were pulled out of the club, actually could survive and wouldn't go on to some kind of normal life.
So I want to spend the last 3 or 4 minutes now on the last piece of what you did in the book, which is bring us the people. Bring us the stories, the families who died, the couples who died, and you brought with you, and we've put this, we've put some pictures of this on the Radio Boston Twitter account, at Radio Boston, so if you want to go there, you can follow along as we talk about this. You brought a remarkable piece of newspaper history here that lays out the people who passed. The pictures are in your book, but it's not the same as seeing this incredible yellowing. Tell us about this.
Yes, this is from a special section of the Boston Advertiser that came out on December 4th, which is just a few days after the fire, really. And I think seeing these pictures, and also I went through the morgue of the Boston Herald. I was working at the Herald, and I was looking at these pictures, and I think that's the thing that affected me the most, just seeing these smiling pictures of people before the fire and thinking of all those lives that were snuffed out that would not be would not go on to have families, to have lives.
I think they went out to dinner.
They went out. Yeah, it was a awful reason to die, just to out for a night on the town, out for some fun, and to go through this horrible experience.
So old and young here, men and women, entire families, almost no one who was Black died because they weren't allowed. You know, I was thinking about this because Wally's, right? There was jazz that happened at the Coconut Grove. Wally's opens 5 years later. We've done conversations here on Radio Boston about the changes that Wally's made over time to other nightclubs because people realized this is where the music is, this is where the market is. Mm-hmm. But this was a largely privileged group, or no?
I would not say they were privileged, but they were white. They were definitely white. As a matter of fact, I think they came from a whole variety of socioeconomic classes. But Blacks were not allowed in the club, although they worked there. And one of the people died.
And there were three that night.
There were three that night, and one of them died.
And two escaped.
And their story is particularly interesting because of the, you know, obviously the racism that they faced in Boston. And it's interesting because I have had so many people come up to me and tell me, oh, my grandfather or my uncle or my grandmother was going to go to the club that night and then couldn't get in or change plans at the last minute, and therefore I'm here. And I've heard that story even from an African American. Said, well, my grandparents were going to go to the club that night, but they were turned away because they were Black. I've heard so many of these stories. They're probably not all true, but here's the point. They all point that everybody felt they could have been at the club that night. This could have happened
could have
to
been them.
Exactly.
And that's a big piece of the legacy in the Boston psyche.
Definitely, definitely. The feeling that it affected all of us, all of the people there at the time, and continues to affect people. I mean, again, every time I give a talk, I have people coming up telling me about their family, telling me about the people. And in a way, there's a question, why did this have to happen? And why don't we all know, why don't we know more about it?
So we're at the 80th anniversary. You wrote the book originally in 2005. You updated it here. Mm-hmm. So 20 years from now, we're going to be at the 100th anniversary. What do you think is the conversation we'll be having about the Coconut Grove nightclub fire then?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say that it's probably more about even more safety precautions that we're taking, more use of materials in clubs, in meeting places that are inflammable, the more enforcement of rules. I mean, the thing about the Coconut Grove is that we've had so many other events after that. I mentioned the Rhode Island nightclub fire, the station.
Yeah.
Then there's the ghost ship in California, in which a number of people, I don't have the people, died because of things that we know are dangerous, but were still going on. So I think in 20 years from now, I hope people are looking back and saying, wow, we used to have a lot of fires, but we've managed to do something about that.
All right. Stephanie Shorrow, historian, author of The Coconut Grove Nightclub Fire, A Boston Tragedy, incredible stories, incredible legacy. Again, you can see the pictures at Radio Boston on Twitter. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.